is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
How can I take 12 or 15 of these guys that all have agendas? They all have agents. They all have friends. They all have goals in life. They all have ego, pride, whatever you want to call it. How do I get them all to mesh and understand that the goal is more important than the role that they're playing? And so I think everybody has that. You know, if you're dealing with youth sports or middle school sports, you still have that. Those kids don't understand that just because they don't get the shot on this play, they could still be just as valuable as the person that takes a shot.
Jamie Beckler spent 20 years as a college basketball coach and administrator. Jamie's teams were known for their rebounding prowess, and he left his last college as the program's all-time winningest coach. His 2014 Martin Methodist College Redhawks women's team earned the National Champions of Character Award. As a John Maxwell certified leadership coach, Jamie works with organizations and teams across the country to help them achieve their leadership potential and create championship cultures. His work with teams have ranged from the NBA to the Big Ten to small colleges. Beckler grew up in Michigan, where he attended Jonesville High School and played basketball for the legendary Bill Dunn. He's a graduate of Hiram College in Ohio, where he lettered in basketball, football, and track. He earned his master's degree in physical education at Kent State, where he began his coaching career as a graduate assistant under Coach Gary Waters. Jamie is the author of numerous e-books and published books, including The Leadership Playbook, and he is also the host of the Success is a Choice podcast. Please leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts and subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. The Hoopheads Pod is available on iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Google Play, and YouTube. Get ready for some terrific insights on leadership, culture, and organization as you listen to this episode with Coach Jamie Beckler.
Hello, and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight, we are here with Jamie Beckler, the host of Success is a Choice podcast. Jamie, welcome.
Hey, thanks, Mike. Thanks, Jason. Appreciate you having me on the show.
And we're excited to have you on the show, get a chance to talk to you about the wide variety of experiences that you've had, both with coaching, with leadership, with your podcast, as an author. There's just a lot of things that we're going to be able to dive into with you. And we want to start by talking a little bit about your childhood and how you grew up playing multiple sports, which eventually led to you being a multi-sport athlete in college. So talk a little bit about your childhood and how it related to your sports background.
Well, you're already starting off being honest and true because you said multi-sport athlete as opposed to multi-sport star. So I appreciate that. Your listeners probably appreciate that. But, you know, I wanted to be Nolan Ryan. That was my man growing up. You know, when he played for the Rangers, I had a Rangers hat. Played for the Astros, I had an Astros hat.
Did you beat up Robin Ventura too?
Man, that was amazing. He took that boy out to the woodshed. That was great. But, you know, I wanted to be Nolan Ryan. And then I remember like third or fourth grade, I don't remember exactly the grade, but I was playing Little League. And my very first pitch I ever had, a kid named Bruce Daniels went yard on me. Very first pitch as a pitcher. So it was all downhill.
It was it.
And I did not become the next Nolan Ryan. But, you know, actually tennis was my first love. That was the first sport I learned was tennis. And, I used to hit the ball off the side of our house. We had a cement slab, that I'd play hoops on as well later on. But, I used that and hit it off our cement wall back onto the cement slab that was under my feet. And, I would pretend I was all the different players and, you name it, I probably acted like that player. And so, that was what I first did. But, yeah, growing up, I mean, I was just, if it was a sport, I was going to play it. And, that probably was a product more of, I lived in the country. We didn't have cable TV. We didn't even have color TV and we didn't have a VCR. So, we weren't Amish, but we certainly didn't have all that kind of stuff. You know, we didn't have Atari. My parents were, working people and we did a lot of outdoor stuff. And so I played sports and, you know, I grew up playing pretty much every sport in every season, and I became pretty good at a number of different sports and, you know, had some success in high school. Got the opportunity to go play college ball at a small school in Ohio. And while I was there, I also, you know, the football team needed football team needed some players. They're I went there to play basketball, but there was a flyer up the first week that I was there, and it said that there's some injuries and the football team needed some players. And I'm like, I went to the basketball coach. I said, "Hey, would you mind if I did this?" And he said, "No, that'd be fine." Now, right there, warning flag should have went off that I wasn't as good of a recruit as I thought I was.
Yeah, but go ahead, Jamie. Go ahead. We don't mind if you spend some time with the ball on the football field.
Yeah. You know, I come in thinking that I'm this pretty good recruit, and that should have been a warning flag that I wasn't. I played for a couple years. Both. I had a knee injury, and so then I ended up playing running track. It was something I didn't want to push it any further. Maybe I was soft or whatever, but I didn't want to push that with the contact sports, and so I ran track. And I did three sports in college, so that was pretty fun. And that pretty much is the sign that I was a pretty mediocre athlete in college, that I was able to do three sports.
Well, you were exposed to a whole bunch of different coaching styles and coaches, I'm sure, through that.
Yeah, I was, and got to, I got to see winning programs. I got to see some losing programs, some different styles of coaching, like you said. And so that was great. And some of those coaches I'm still in contact with to this day. And some of those coaches really kind of helped shape who I was as a coach later on. But, I got to experience a lot of things, and, I wish I was a better athlete. Obviously I was a decent enough athlete to play multiple sports in college, but I wasn't a star by any means in college. And so I kind of, when I went into coaching, I kind of took that mentality that I kind of understood. I went from being a star, to some respects in high school, to being somebody that was, no coach really wanted him on the team, hey, go ahead and go play some other sport, in college. But, that was fun. I got to meet a lot of friends. In fact, just a couple of weeks ago out in Vegas, I'm walking in Caesars or the Bellagio. And all of a sudden someone said, like, Jamie. And it was an old player that I played basketball with in college. I hadn't talked to him since probably the day we graduated, but we follow each other on LinkedIn or social media. So that was kind of cool.
Yeah, it's very cool. There's always good bonds, I think, especially with your college teammates, because you go through so many different things with them. And it's such an intense experience that, when you do see them, even if you don't see them all the time, it's kind of like you can fall back right into those conversations and that relationship, that even if you don't see somebody all the time, you're able to be able to reconnect and do that. Did you always know when you were growing up that coaching was going to be a part of your future? Or was that something that sort of, once the ball stopped bouncing for you, you looked around and said, "Hey, maybe coaching is a way for me to stay involved in athletics"?
Well, certainly I wanted to be a professional athlete. And so, early on I was like, if I can't be a professional athlete, then I'd like to be a coach. And early on my coaches let me know that, I was probably going to be a coach. I just tried to watch my coaches, learn from my coaches, tried to understand why it is that they did some things the way that they did them. And there were some times where I probably didn't do it the right way, especially in high school, where I might come across as a know-it-all, or not a know-it-all, but kind of questioning them. And I was really trying to question, why they were doing something so that I could learn, so I could be a better coach one day. But, I would love to say that when I'm in seventh and eighth grade, I'm really deep and can say, "Well, hey, I want to be a coach because I want to impact people the way that my coaches have impacted me." I wasn't that deep, but I did read a John Wooden book, They Call Me Coach, in seventh grade. And I love the way that John Wooden cared about his players, even the ones that weren't playing. And I was like, "Man, I want a coach like that." So I wasn't necessarily thinking, "Man, I want to be that coach," but I was thinking, "Man, that's the kind of coach I want to play for. That's important to me, that whether I'm hitting my shot or not hitting my shot or having 11 turnovers or zero turnovers, that my coach still loves me."
Yeah, that's a great point. Wooden obviously is known for being that way with all his players. And I've had the good fortune of getting a chance to meet and know Sven Nader a little bit. And for those people out there who maybe don't know who Sven is, he was the backup center on UCLA's Bill Walton teams. And he was the only player who never started a college game that was a first-round NBA draft choice. And at one point, I know he led the league in rebounding. And he always tells this story that, people would ask him all the time, "Well, why are you staying at UCLA when you could go to these other schools and get a chance to play, and you're playing behind Walton and you never get to play. And his response was always that he would have these conversations with Coach Wooden, and Coach Wooden would tell him that, you know, what better way is there for you to get better and improve than to play against the best player in the country and practice every single day. And, you know, Coach Wooden just had a way, he said, of being able to inspire and be able to build those relationships with both Bill Walton, who was obviously the biggest star in the game at that point, and with Sven Nader, who at that point in his career, nobody had ever heard of. And Sven just always says that Coach Wooden was able to build those relationships with every single player, from player number one all the way down to player 15. And I think that that's one of the things that, as I've gotten older, that has become important to me. I don't know that it was important to me when I was a young coach, that those relationships and building character and teaching life lessons, I'm not sure those things were very important to me when I was 24, 25, 26. But as I've gotten older, I've come to realize that, you know, basketball stops for everybody at some point, or whatever sport it is that you're playing. What's important is that as a coach, you're building up the people that are under your charge. And most often those are young kids or young adults. And it's really important that we give them some of those things that are going to impact them for the rest of their life, and not just teach them how to shoot a left-handed layup or how to run a set play.
Well, you're right. And you look at, you know, when we're recording this, you know, this week, Dwayne Wade and Dirk Nowitzki retired, and, you know, they're old by NBA standards, but you know, you would think that they have more life still to live than they've lived already. You know, they have more years left in them. So that's even with an NBA player, you know, the lessons they learn, the character they build is going to be more useful than those basketball dribbling skills. And it's more so for a college kid who may never play pro, and certainly more for a youth player or a high school player that's never going to go to college or never going to play pro, is that your basketball career, though we think that's the biggest thing going on right now, that's something that's going to, it's finite. It's going to end, and it's going to end sooner than most of us want, but we're going to live the rest of our life. We're going to have a lot of years where we have to be a champion of character, where we have to be a champion in life.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that, sometimes it's a struggle with youth sports, especially because of whether it's coaches, whether it's parents, whether it's just the way the system is set up, that unfortunately you see in a lot of places that the emphasis is placed on winning as opposed to the process of really developing better people along with developing better players. And I think this is one of the things I've had a conversation with lots of other coaches about it, and I want to kind of get your take on it. And that is, I believe that there's a lot of education that needs to go into not just coaches, but also parents, because a lot of times what parents see, even at the, you know, as young as the third, fourth, fifth grade level, we see it in basketball all the time where parents are chasing these quote winning teams. And yet you watch some of the coaches on those particular teams or those particular organizations, and a lot of times the emphasis is just on how can we win, and the actual, you know, the character of the players, the life lessons that could be taught are completely overlooked. And a lot of times these parents just are chasing winning. And I think that's a dangerous game to get into. What's your take on kind of that, the youth sports space when it comes to leadership and character development versus winning?
Yeah, I think you're spot on there, Mike. And certainly we're painting with a broad brush because not every parent's that way.
Absolutely.
You know, but in the same vein, you know, those parents that have their perspectives out of whack, they tend to not be the quiet ones. They tend to be the ones that are right there at the forefront, you know, in the center of everything. And so that can tend to skew a kid's perspective on the way things are, and it can also put undue pressure on a coach. Now, there's enough coaches out there too that they would rather win than have a kid be a great member of the society 20 years from now. Like, they want to win now. It's a notch on their belt. And I've been at enough basketball camps growing up as a counselor or something, where, you know, each coach or each counselor has a team, and they're acting like, you know, they're going to put that on their resume. They're acting like this is, you know, when they win that league, that trophy at the end of the week, that's going to get them a job at Michigan or Ohio State. And it's like, you know, dude, you just got that team assigned to you. You know, you got the 3 6'2" 7th graders, you know, that are here at camp. Of course you won. You know, but there are a lot of coaches that are skewed with their perspective as well. And you know, I do think, and not to be the, you know, old man on the lawn type, but our society has placed too much emphasis on winning. You know, I love the Nick Saban, you know, where he preaches process all the time. Now I know a cynic can say, well, yeah, it's easy to preach process when you have all those 5-star athletes and you're winning all the time. But you know, everyone else in the SEC has 5-star athletes. You know, what he's doing is different than other programs. The same way John Wooden didn't talk a lot about winning. He talked about the process. He talked about what we're going to do each day to get better. And you know, the best coaches, that's what they're doing. And they're also competent coaches. You know, some of these coaches are very, they're not competent. And we see that, you know, recently in the NCAA tournament, you know, Tom Izzo got a lot of criticism for the way that he treated and acted with one of his players. And I happen to be a huge Tom Izzo fan, and I happen to think that was okay in his situation for his team. The problem with that, though, is we latch onto that and we say, see, that's okay. No. That's not necessarily okay. It was okay for him, that situation, and that kid. And they know that he loves them. They know that that's the best thing, way to be coached that way. The same way Greg Popovich could dog cuss out Tim Duncan, and Tim Duncan was okay with that, because if they're going to have difficult conversations and difficult situations, they're going to have a strong and tough love, or a strong connection, a strong bond if they're going to have that tough love. But we as coaches, we take those kind of things and we say, hey, it's okay to do it because Tom Izzo did it. Or it's okay to do it because, you know, fill in the blank. And the problem sometimes is we're not doing what we need to do as coaches to add value to our kids, to lift them up, to teach them those lessons that they need to learn. You know, it's not about, hey, I'm going to explain to you why I just yelled at you. It really should probably be, hey, you know what? I don't need to yell at you, or I don't need to act in this way, because I've made clear what our expectations are. And I am adding value to you. I'm adding some significance to your life. I'm doing all that I can to uplift you and encourage you and teach you what you need to know. And a lot of times we just yell at kids like, hey, you missed that block out, and we go off on them. And it's like, yeah, but you didn't spend much time in practice working on that, or you don't emphasize that enough. And I'm kind of going off on a rant a little bit, but I do think coaches don't do it right too often. And I know the question was about parents. But one of the easiest way to get parents off your back sometimes is to make sure that you're very competent and that they have trust that what you're doing is the right thing. Not that it's going to win, but that's the right thing.
Yeah, I want to go out back on two things you said. The first one is in relationship to Tom Izzo and that whole thing. I think that what people forget, and it kind of goes to what you were saying, in that you see Tom Izzo yell at a player and people just see that and say, oh, that's okay. Or, oh, you know, that was terrible. Whatever your opinion might be. But a coach who takes that and says, well, Tom Izzo yells at his players, so I can yell at my players. What they don't see is the relationship and the amount of time that Tom Izzo's put in with that kid to be able to get that kid to trust him, to believe in what Tom Izzo is doing, so that when something like that does occur and Tom Izzo does coach to his personality and the way that he is, if you sign up to, you know, go and play at Michigan State, you have a pretty good awareness that occasionally Tom Izzo is going to yell at you. But you also know that he cares about you, that he's putting in a tremendous amount of time, that he's a competent coach. Whereas a coach who just sees Tom Izzo yelling at a player and then says, hey, I can yell at players too, is discounting all the work that went into building that relationship up in the first place. And so that's one piece of it. And then the second thing that you said that I think is really important is, when you're a coach, if you're not competent, it makes it very difficult for you to interact with your players in a positive way, to be able to sell your program to parents. And I think it's one of the things that we really need to do a better job of. And I think it's, you know, we just talked to Mike Jones and he's involved with USA Basketball. We've had a couple of USA Basketball guys here. And one of the things that they're trying to do is bring coach education to all the great volunteer coaches that we have across the United States, in the game of basketball. And obviously it's not just basketball. It has volunteer sport, volunteer coaches, but USA Basketball is trying to get everybody to get licensed and go through that program. And it's not a cure all, but it does provide some basic training for those volunteer coaches who may never have had an opportunity to work with kids at the fifth grade level or the eighth grade level. And when you provide that base level of education, you give them the idea that, look, it's not just about knowing how to set up some set plays or how to run X's and O's or what great drill to run. It's also about the side of it where you're teaching those life lessons, where you're working on character, where you're incorporating teachable moments every single time that you step on the practice floor. There are things that kids can learn about life in the game. So I think those two points are, one, coaches need to build relationships, which allows you to coach your players harder. Is that something that you'd agree with?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're spot on. You know, you want to have tough love or you're going to have difficult conversations, and you better have strong bonds that can back up that tough love, that can back up those difficult conversations. And you're right, Mike. A lot of us as coaches, we see what Tom Izzo does, let's say, and we're like, hey, we can do that too. But we haven't, there's not that unseen hours. There's not that sweat equity in the background that's earned us the right to get on a kid. And another thing too, the majority of people listening to this can't recruit their players like Tom Izzo does. Even if there's a college basketball coach listening to this, they probably don't have the situation Tom Izzo does at Michigan State. And so you are not in a position, most of your listeners, to pick 12 or 15 players that you know are going to be able to take this coaching the way that Tom Izzo's players can. So even if you're building up that sweat equity in the unseen hours or behind the scenes, you may not have all the players that a Tom Izzo has or a Gino Auriemma at UConn in women's basketball has that can take that kind of coaching.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's when you do that and you do it without the relationship, that's when you get into trouble. And I think a lot of people think of coaching, especially people who aren't in the coaching profession, think of coaching as the technical side of it. And what kind of X's and O's do I know? And can I teach this particular skill? And can I go on YouTube and grab a bunch of drills? And that's really what people think of as coaching. And what I find, and you know, I teach during the day as my quote real job. And so I kind of take it for granted that I can organize kids, and I've been running a basketball camp for young players for a long, long time. And I know how to organize kids into groups and get them on this team and here and move and put them in places. And it all works very seamlessly. And I'm always kind of amazed when I'll go and I've had, like, just as an example, volunteers for field day, and a class of kids will come over to that parent, and the parent just has to split them in two teams, and it's chaos for like 5 minutes, and they have no idea how to split them up or get their attention or do anything. And I kind of take those things for granted. And a lot of times volunteer coaches are in the position, not of having a background like mine, but having a background more like the parent that I just described at field day. And as a result, you know, they might know something about the sport. They may have learned something. They may have done some work to get prepared.
ESPN.
Yeah, they may have watched a game on ESPN, you know, who knows, but they don't know, they don't understand the, you know, the way to organize that. And I think if we could give, you know, our volunteer coaches across the country the education of how do you just go about taking those skills that aren't necessarily directly translatable to basketball, but could apply to any sport, just in terms of practice organization and interacting with kids and how to, you know, how do I deal with an 8-year-old versus a 12-year-old, and what's the difference, their different personalities. I think we'd have a lot better situation in all of our, you know, all of our sports programs across the landscape.
Well, John Wooden, we mentioned him earlier, and he used to say that he spent more time planning his practice than the actual practice session itself. And, you know, certainly youth coaches, that's hard for them to do, or even high school level, that's hard to do. But if we took a little bit more time to be more efficient with our practices, then maybe we wouldn't have such bored players, quote unquote, bored players. We wouldn't have players that are unengaged. We wouldn't have players that, you know, are stupid in the games or idiots in the games, or, you know, how can you forget that? Well,
right.
Because practice was so boring, you know, they weren't engaged and it didn't sink in. They didn't internalize what you were saying. You know, you said it four times, but, you know, in a 2-hour practice, they got 3 reps. on that one thing, you know, or whatever, you know, I'm throwing this out there, but we've got to do a better job of not having bored players. And I'm amazed at how many coaches, and I was like this too early on, how many of us expect that, you know, at the high school level, that the 15-year-old is going to be mature one, or at my level at the college game, that a 20-year-old is going to be the mature one and be able to stay engaged and attentive for 2 hours, you know, when they're getting hit and when they're running and they're sweating. You know, we can't expect that. So we've got to do something to help them and to equip them and empower them to learn a little bit better. And you know, how we think that a 15-year-old's not going to get bored during a 2-hour practice is beyond me.
So in your mind, what's the best way to go about doing that? What are some suggestions you would have for coaches in terms of practice organization or in terms of how to keep things active and keep the players engaged while they're at practice?
Yeah, first of all, have a plan for everything that you're doing. Don't just go over your plays 5-on-0, so to speak. And I'm painting with a broad brush, but don't go over your plays 5-on-0 for 30 minutes. And then you scrimmage for 30 minutes with no point to that scrimmage. And then when you want to break or you want to talk about what you're going to do next, you have them shoot free throws. And certainly that's a generalization, but have a plan for everything that you're doing. And I'm not saying scrimmaging is bad. I'm not saying drills are bad. But whatever you're going to do, have a point to it. And I'm not saying that, all right, we're going to do this for 10 minutes and then we're going to move on, because there's different sides to that coin as well. But have a way to measure your progress. What are you trying to accomplish out of this drill? What are you trying to accomplish out of this scrimmage situation? Whatever your kids are going to face, then try to prepare them for that, whether it's special situations, whether it's just how you're going to inbound the ball. You know, I've seen so many practices where, you know, the other team, you're scrimmaging and the other team scores a basket, and the kid taking the ball out just throws the ball against the wall to inbound it, or, you know, they don't even step out of bounds to inbound it. And it's like, that's not game-like. And you don't have to be a taskmaster and be all about, you know, such the nitty-gritty and all the little details, but what are you trying to get out of everything that you're doing? And then keep it fast paced, because one of the things that we struggle with as coaches is we will almost always talk negatively about the intelligence of our players. You know, they're not very smart. They're not bright, whatever it is, fill in the blank. But you watch our practices and they're very slow paced. There's a lot of time for them to think. There's a lot of downtime. Well, we don't develop their brains. We don't develop their quick thinking skills. And I remember I was in college when I saw my first Bobby Knight clinic on VCR tape. And Bobby Knight said, I don't get the fastest guys afoot, but I try to make them fast in their brains. I try to make my slow guys quicker by making them think quicker. And so, you know, if we have a boring practice or a slow practice, well, then we're going to not develop those. You know, this isn't a scientific thing, but we're not going to develop a quick twitch muscle in their brain. You know, we're not going to develop their brains where they think quickly, where they're having to react to things quickly like they would in a game. And so keep it moving. I go back to the camp thing. I mentioned camp earlier. Well, a good basketball camp, you're not going to have kids sitting around. You're going to have lots of balls at the basket. You're going to have drills where kids can be involved. Do that. You don't need kids sitting out all day long at your practices. You know, things, just little things like that, make things competitive. Take a drill, figure out, you know, take 5 minutes while you're driving instead of listening to the radio, or unless you're listening, of course, to the Hoop Heads podcast.
There you go. Or success is a choice.
Yeah. But when, and your downtime when you're driving on your commute, man, take 5 minutes and think of, okay, I like this drill. How can I make it better? How can I take it one level up, to take it to the next level, make it a little bit more advanced? Maybe we can get double work out of this. Or maybe, you know, like for instance, every shooting drill that we did, I added a rebounding component to it, because rebounding was our number one thing as a college team. And so I wanted to add a rebounding component to every shooting drill. And that included free throws during water breaks. Everything, there was a rebounding component to every shooting drill. So something like that. How can I make this better? How can I get double work out of this? How can I make the rotations quicker? How can I spend 3 minutes talking about this drill on the court instead of 10 minutes talking about it on the court? And we tend to do that as coaches too. We make it our classroom and we talk way too long on the basketball court. How can I be quicker in what I'm saying?
Yeah, I love that. We talked to Liam Flynn, who's from Australia, and he's a pro coach over there. And one of the things that he talked about that I really like, and I'm guilty of this, I know, is he talked about how important it is to teach with cues. So he would teach a concept and then give that concept a cue word. And then from that point forward, when he yelled whatever that cue word was, the players knew exactly what he was talking about. He didn't have to stop and go into his, you know, 1 minute, 2 minute, 3 minute explanation. The players had already heard that explanation once, and then the cue was designed to, that would be something that he could, whether it was in practice or in a game, he could yell corners and the players knew exactly what he meant. So I think that's a great, you know, way to go about shortening up the amount of time you talk. Cause you mentioned it earlier, when you're talking to a bunch of 14-year-olds and you're talking for 4 minutes, after 15 seconds, those kids have tuned you out. So if you can't get your message across to them in 15 seconds, whatever you're saying beyond that probably isn't sinking in anyway. So learning to teach with cues or coach with cues, I think is really important. And the other thing I liked you said is trying to incorporate multiple things into a drill. And I'll take that one step further and maybe even simplify that even more. One of the things that I'll see, especially when I have young coaches that work at camp with me, is they'll set up a drill and it'll be a pretty good drill, but they'll have 8 kids or 9 kids or 10 kids standing in one line. And I'll say, well, why don't you just make 4 lines? And yeah, it's a little bit more chaotic at the basket or there's more going on, but the game itself is chaotic. So you're kind of trying to keep more kids engaged in what you're doing, and you never want to have people standing around. So if you can take a drill that's good and take it from one line and take it to 4 lines, now you've just made 4 more kids getting reps and getting more opportunities to play. And I think that's really important when it comes to designing a good practice.
Yeah, that is a great point. Another thing, I did this early on. I went to a Nike clinic and I saw Kelvin Sampson when he was at Oklahoma, and he did this great drill, this elbow shooting drill that, you know, it wasn't real complicated, but it was a great drill, timed, you kept track. It was really cool. And I went back and the next week we implemented it, and we did it for 2 days in practice. And then one of my players said, Coach, man, this drill has been awesome, but my question is, you don't let us shoot anything but 3-pointers and layups, so why are we doing this drill?
That's awesome.
I was like, man, touche. I was like, why aren't you that smart on the basketball court? You know,
What
in the world is going on here? You're asking
good questions.
But sometimes we do a great drill, but there's not a point to it, or it doesn't play into what we're doing as a program or what our theory is. And so I don't think we got to have a million drills either as a coach. You know, I think we can get good work out of quality of drills, and we don't have to have 50 different, you know, rebounding drills or 50 different shooting drills. You know, if we have some good ones, and like you were talking about the coach who was talking about cues,
yes,
you know, man, if your kids know exactly what that drill is, when you say a word, when you say a cue word for your drill, you know, all of a sudden that cuts down 30 seconds or 60 seconds or 90 seconds of, wait, what is that one again? How do we do this? Can you remind us how we do this? And so when you have 20 different drills of the same thing, it's awfully hard to remember all those drills.
It really is. I remember when I was in college that we were very organized. And so the drill would, you know, be said and boom, immediately everybody would expect it to be where you were needed to be for that particular drill. And it was just, you know, very, very efficient, where you were getting to your spots and doing what you wanted to do. And I'm hit or miss on that, to be honest with you. I know there are times where, you know, I have some drills that have a name and kids know what they are. And then I have other ones that we do all the time, but I don't have a name for it. And they're like, oh yeah, like, what is that one again? Can you explain that? And where do we go? And, you know, whereas if I did a better job of being more organized in terms of naming everything, it would go a lot faster. So I definitely can agree with you on, you know, that particular point as well.
Well, two things. One is, once again, take some time in the car when you're driving to think of some names, maybe think of some popular singers, like have a Post Malone or a Drake
Mike,
drill.
No, does Mike know who Post Malone is?
Well, is that Moses's brother?
Yeah, it's what Moses did when he went down low, he posted right up Post
there
Malone. But the other thing is just ask your kids, what do you want to name this drill? And give them some, I know we'll get into leadership stuff in a little bit, but that's a way to get them doing some leadership and to empower them a little bit. Have them come up with some names. You don't have to be the creative one.
So I coach middle school basketball in Olmsted Falls, and the kids this year wanted to name a play Tater Nuggets. I don't know why, but I let them do it because, like you said, it gave them the power. They thought they were, you know, it made them feel good, and we called a play called Tater Nuggets.
The only problem is then you got to be on the sideline yelling Tater Nuggets like a maniac. That's the only problem.
It was amusing, and the parents thought it was hilarious.
Yeah, well, I had my girls' team. My daughter, who's now in ninth grade, but last year when they were in eighth, she has a team of girls that they got together in seventh grade. They're all from different schools, and they all get along so well, and they're so much fun to coach. And we were going through our out-of-bounds plays, and my son is 2 years behind her, so we do a lot of the same things with the two teams just to keep my own sanity. And so I named the out-of-bounds plays with the boys' team. You know, they don't care what the names are, so we just named them 1, 2, and 3. And then the girls are like, they can't be 1, 2, and 3, so they named them fruits. So I had to stand on the sideline yelling, you know, tangerine, tangerine. But they enjoyed it. They got a kick out of it. To your point, Jamie, that they gave them some ownership in what it was doing, what the plays were, and they remembered them. So,
well, there was a coach I knew, a Division I basketball coach down in Texas, coached women. His name was Wooly. But Wooly, the very first time I watched him coach a game, I could not believe how bad of a coach he was on the sideline, because he would always call out like his plays. He'd be like, I don't care, whatever. You do what you want. And those are the names of his plays.
That's awesome.
So, if the kids think it's fun, especially if the parents think it's fun, you know, that's one of those things. You don't have to be married to that. And as a coach, you know, pick your battles, pick the things that you can afford to give up. And if you don't care, go ahead and do that within reason, of course.
Absolutely. No question about that. So I want to talk a little bit about your college coaching career and start out with the question of when you first started and you took over as the head coach for the first time, what were some of the biggest challenges that you faced, and what were some things that when you look back on, you weren't very good at that you improved on over the course of your career?
Well, the very first thing I think of, I was on the job for about a month, and I took over a NCAA Division III program in Texas, and I was from Indiana, or I would last coached in Indiana, and it was my first women's job. I had always coached men, and so I took this job in Texas, NCAA Division III school, and 1 month after taking this job, I'm at a major recruiting event. And the very first three girls that I went to talk to about coming to my school, literally the first three girls, had already committed to Texas, VCU, and Texas Tech.
So you had to determine the level, I guess, is what you're saying.
I certainly, as someone who had been coaching men, had no idea. And now, granted, I only seen about two basketball games in the previous 3 or 4 years of women's basketball, because our teams play. Well, our teams. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The glass is half full. I can pick out good players, but you know, our teams played on the same nights. You know, if our men's team was at home, the women's team was on the road. So I never really got to see them play. And so I didn't know the levels. And, I just was like, man, they got jump shots, you know, they got actual jump shots and they can do pull-up jumpers. I want those players in my program. Well, yeah, so did Texas. But, you know, that was the first thing, you know, simplifying it. I had to learn the women's game. So I had a disadvantage over some coaches. And, you know, some coaches that when they take over a first-year program, they're not going to have that issue, you know, unless they're really moving up a significant level. I moved into a different gender, so to speak. And so, you know, I had to adjust to some of my evaluations. I had to adjust to you know, some of my end of the game plays, some of those things like that. I mean, physically, a female's not going to get the ball down the court in 2 seconds, you know, or something where the fastest guy's going to do. Some of your listeners remember Tyus Edney for UCLA back in the 90s when he went coast to coast in just a couple seconds. You know, that doesn't happen as much in the women's game. So I had to adjust some of those plays that I had. But really, the you know, that was kind of a basketball thing. But coaching wise, I just had to, and it really took me 4 years, honestly, to learn this. But it didn't matter if I was the smartest guy there or not, if I was the smartest guy in the room, because it was really what can I teach my players? What can I equip them to do? What can I, you know, empower them to do? Not how much do I know? You know, and you know, I like to tell this story, you know, and I wish I remembered it when I first started off coaching. It was only afterwards, once I got into it. But, you know, in high school, I'm walking down the street with my mom and I have to get across, you know, we have to cross the street, and like a punk kid, I'm not going to wait for the crosswalk. I'm just going to go. And I start to walk across the street and she grabs my arm and, you know, what are you doing, Jamie? And I'm like, well, I'm walking across the street. She goes, you can't do that. Cars are coming. I said, Mom, seriously, I got this. Pedestrians have the right of way. And I'll never forget, you know, I wish I'd remembered this early on, but she said, yeah, and you'll be dead right. Well, my first 4 years of being a head coach, I was dead right all the time. I mean, I'm running Pat Summitt's rebounding or Pat Summitt's defense. I'm doing Tom Izzo's rebounding. I'm doing, you know, Coach K's offense, and we're not getting the job done. So obviously it's the player's fault. Well, you know, it doesn't matter that we were doing the right stuff. I wasn't coaching the right way. I wasn't adding value to my players enough. And so that would be the biggest mistake I made as a young coach, was that, you know, I didn't find out what made each of my players tick. You know, what I did was I coached the way I thought that each player should tick, the way that they should go about their business. Well, they're not going to be as committed as I am. They're not going to care as much as I am. You know, they're not always going to put their heart and soul into every practice. And I didn't adjust. You know, I kept saying, yeah, this is the way it should be. This is the way it should be. But I was dead right all the time.
Registration is now open at www.headstartbasketball.com for this summer's Head Start Basketball Camps. We'll be hosting camps this summer in Strongsville, Westlake, Avon Lake, Oberlin, Brunswick, Highland Heights, Mentor, and Hudson. At Head Start Basketball, we care deeply about making a positive impact on the lives of young basketball players, both on and off the court. It's through building strong relationships with our players, parents, and coaching staff that we are able to use the game of basketball to enrich the lives of those we interact with, both inside and outside of our organization. We believe that our attention to detail, our growth mindset, and our commitment to lifelong learning allows us to help our players achieve their fullest potential. We are passionately committed to providing players, parents, and coaches with everything they need to reach their goals. These core values run through everything we do. Check out our website, www.headstartbasketball.com, and discover why you should attend a Head Start Basketball Camp this summer. Hope to see you there.
So how did you go about changing that? When you say you're going to build those relationships, you're going to get to know what makes each player tick, how do you go about doing that as a coach? What were some of the things that you did to make that happen?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the main things that I did was when the athletic director said, hey, Jamie, can you step into my office? I stepped into his office, and then he said, hey, we're going to let you resign at the end of the year. That was one of the first things I did, was accepting his offer to step into his office. You know, I like to say that I'm better at achieving goals than most people, because I achieved my goal twice. My goal was to be an NCAA division or NCAA coach by the age of 32. And at the age of 27, I was an NCAA head coach. And then I got fired. And then by the age of 32, I was a head coach again. So nice. I achieved that goal twice. But, you know, those first 4 years, I was dead right a lot. And then it was only really getting resigned, you know, getting fired, that it was really a wake up call. And it's like, you know what, you've been stubborn, or you thought that you knew what you were doing, because you were, you know, you worked so hard, you did so many good things to be an assistant, to get to where you are at a young age. You thought you knew it all, but you really didn't know anything, you know. And even though you cared, there was never an issue that I didn't care about my players. The issue was always, and this goes back to the Tom Izzo thing, too many of us as coaches, and I was there, we care a great deal about our players. They don't know that, though. And each player, almost each player, needs to know that in a different way. You know, you're not going to be able to to, you know, all right, well, these 10 players, if I do this, these 10 players are going to know that I care about them. It almost has to be a one-on-one. Every individual player is going to have to know in their own way that you care about them and that what you're telling them or doing is has their best interest in mind, or this is, you know, it might not have their best interest in mind in terms of the basketball, but they're going to know that you're not doing it maliciously, or you're not doing it, you know, it, with any kind of malice or mean spiritedness to it. And I cared about my players a great deal. They just didn't know it. And so I couldn't get them to run through a brick wall, even though I kept banging my head against that brick wall, because why aren't you going to do that? Because you should do it. And I care about you. Well, they didn't really know that because I didn't take the time to truly dive into who they were and talk to them, you know. And this could be as little as, you know, if you make a change in the starting lineup, you know, the way that you approach that person. And we, you know, I think Nick Saban does an amazing job at Alabama with his team, but even he this last year had an issue where, you know, he had a quarterback speaking out to the media that he was unhappy, that the coaching staff didn't talk to him the way that, you know, well, they never told me why I got benched. Well, you know, anyone with half a brain that follows football is like, they don't have to talk to you because everyone knows Alabama's program is about competing and they're going to do what it takes to win, you know, or they're going to put the best people out there each day. But that might be the case. But still, this young man didn't feel like the coaching staff talked to him enough. So even at that high of a level, sometimes there's that issue of players' feelings. You know, I worked with the Toronto Raptors doing some leadership stuff. And even working with them, you realize they might have millions of dollars in their pocket, but they still have feelings and they still have ego. And so as coaches, we can't forget that sometimes. And we have to take care of, if we got 15 players in our program, we got to understand that all 15 have egos and feelings, and they might even change from day to day. And we've got to be attuned to that, because if we're not, we might have problems down the road. We might, what we do today or what we say to them today might be the start of losing them. And then all of a sudden we're going to wonder why we have a bad program or why we're losing or why I'm getting called into the athletic director's office to get fired.
Yeah, absolutely. I read something and I wish that I could think of where that I could give credit for where I read it, but it said something to the effect of, you know, we know ourselves, and thinking of us as a coaches, we know ourselves by our thoughts, because so much of what we do is we're thinking internally about, I care about my players. I want the best for them. I want to see them be successful. And we're having those kinds of thoughts in our own mind all the time. But other people judge us by our actions and the words that we speak, and not by our thoughts, because they're not privy to those thoughts. And as you were talking, that quote, that story just kind of came jumping out at me that, you know, most of us have good intentions. We have this idea that my players should know I care about them. Of course I care about them. Well, how do they think I don't care about them? And yet the player might be sitting on their stool in front of their locker going, man, this guy never doesn't care about me. He never says anything nice to me. He's always on my case. He never asked me about how school's going, or, you know, what's going on with my family, or how my dog is, or, you know, whatever it might be. And while we are in our own heads thinking how much we care about the players, and I think that's the point that you're trying to get across, which I think is a great one, is you have to not only think it, but you have to really make it known for your players in order to get buy-in. You have to get them to understand by your actions, by your words, that yes, in fact, you do care about them. And then that allows you to get them to run through that brick wall for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why, you know, I that's why a Greg Popovich can, you know, dog cuss out Tim Duncan, or, you know, Hall of Famers. That's why Tom Izzo can get on a player, you know, because they have spent the time with those kids, because those kids or those adults or those people know that those coaches have their best interest in mind. You know, and some of us as coaches, we don't ever get to that point of a player or a parent will give us the benefit of the doubt. You know, they're just going to naturally assume that we have an agenda, or that we're selfish, or that we're not, we don't care about their kid or this person. And, you know, so, and, you know, if it sounds like this is a lot of work or it's tough, that's because it is. It really is. And, And that's what makes the best coaches so good. But it also makes, you know, a lot of bad coaches, because a lot of coaches aren't willing to do this. You know, it's like you mentioned earlier, you know, putting in a new play or, you know, that's some easy stuff. Well, you know, I mean, I know what to do for my wife on Sweetest Day and on Valentine's Day and on our anniversary and her birthday and her Christmas. You know, I know the template, you know, the flowers and the chocolate and the jewelry. Okay, but it's the other 350 days of the year, the 355 days of the year, that's the hard part that really makes or breaks a relationship. And, you know, you can, as a coach, you can put in the right play or do the right thing X's and O's wise, but it's those little things every day that really makes or breaks your culture and your ultimately your program.
I think it comes down to communication. You know, you mentioned with parents, you mentioned with players, and I think so much of the difficulty sometimes that coaches have on both of those fronts can be headed off by proactive communication as opposed to reactive communication. Is that something that you experienced in your coaching career, and maybe kind of elaborate on that particular point at all?
Yeah, that's a great point. And as a coach, think of potential problems too. What are some potential pitfalls that you're going to encounter? And right now, every coach listening to this could sit down and probably fill up a legal pad of paper on all the issues or the drama that will happen this next year or will probably happen this next year. And so what are some of the things, some of those things we shoot ourselves in the foot for, and we don't, we're not prepared for it. And we act like, well, it's not going to happen. Or like you said, we react to it. And one thing that's kind of controversial among coaches to a degree when it comes to communication, and I was like this early on, is I'm not going to talk about playing time. You know, you'll tell a parent this or whatever. I'm not going to talk about your kid's role. I'm not going to talk about their playing time. Well, I'm not saying that that's wrong for a coach to do, but the question I would ask is, if a parent has a question about something, you know, even an uncomfortable topic, and you don't talk to them about that, it's not like they're just going to give you the benefit of the doubt and say, oh, coach knows what he's doing. They're going to get that information somewhere. They're going to have that narrative or that story told to them. And I like to use the phrase, when you avoid something, you will create a void that will be filled by something. So if you avoid some of those conversations, that void will be filled at some point, and it's probably not going to be by one of your allies. You know, so we should be proactive in the way we're talking to our kids, proactive in the way we're talking to our administration, our parents, about a lot of things. And don't assume, you know, and I think of one thing, you asked for a couple things. I think of one thing, how many times are parents confused about what door to pick their kids up at after practice, or what time practice ends, or where the bus is going to drop people off or pick people up, you know, little things like that, because a lot of times we assume our kids are going to tell them that. And once again, this is a 14 or a 15 year old. Why are we assuming that they're going to remember stuff and tell their parents the right stuff? You know, if that happens, great, but we can be proactive some way of letting parents know that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that engenders goodwill too. Those little things with parents, when you take care of all those little details that, you know, you mentioned picking them up at the right door at the right time, when that gets thrown off, especially in today's busy society, when parents are at the wrong door or your practice is 15 minutes late or your game is switched to a different location and you don't communicate that stuff, that's the stuff that angers parents on a small level. And then those little small angers eventually end up in a large anger. If there's some other problem that might have been small, the accumulation of all those little annoyances sometimes can add up to big problems for coaches. And I've seen that happen before.
Yeah, most of us aren't good enough coaches to overcome a whole bunch of those little things. And yet those little things are a lot of times the things that you know, sink us a lot of times. And so we need to take care of some of that stuff and just think about what issues could come up and then try to be proactive about it. And, you know, I just think, you know, we can communicate with our players a little bit better. We can communicate with parents a little bit better, and it doesn't have to be an us versus them, type of thing with everybody. Now, are you going to have, if you have 15 parents that you have to deal with or work with, are you going to have, you know, a pain in the butt? Yeah, you're probably going to have one. And no matter what you do, there's going to be somebody that's negative. There's people out there in this world that have to be negative about everything. And I think back to a great quote I love by a former president, Lyndon Baines Johnson, LBJ. He said that if I walked across the Potomac, if I walked on water across the Potomac, somebody would be upset that their president doesn't know how to swim. There are people out there that are going to be negative about everything. You can't worry about pleasing everybody, but you can, but you need to worry about pleasing the people that, that you can affect or, you know, doing what you can do. And I don't think as coaches, we always communicate as well as we can for whatever reason. It's too much work or, well, I don't need to communicate because little Johnny's going to do that. Or you look at it as an adversarial type relationship and you don't need to, you know, you can win parents over.
Yeah, you absolutely can. I think if you go into it, to me, it comes back to what I said earlier with being proactive versus reactive. And if you can proactively communicate with parents what your expectations are, what the standards are in your program, and we could go through a whole list of things that you could share with parents prior to the season or prior to you engaging with their student athlete. If you do that beforehand, then when situations do arise, one, you've already sort of talked about those particular situations and how you would handle it, so the parent has some idea of where you're coming from, and you've built some positive vibes with that parent so that when something negative does occur, you can kind of dip into that bank of positive vibes that you've deposited earlier and maybe come to an agreement with a parent versus the parent that you've never talked to, never communicated with. All of a sudden they come in and they have, you know, again, there's that void that you talked about earlier where they don't know what Coach Beckler, they don't know what Coach Klinsing is going to say when they walk through that door of the coach's office or when they sit down for a meeting. And so that tends to set up that adversarial relationship that you described versus, hey, we're on the same team. We want the best for your child. We want the best for our team. And if we come to that agreement, we're going to be much more likely to reach a solution that, you know, that works for everybody. And at the same time, I tell people all the time that if you're going to be a successful coach, not everybody is going to love what you do. There's going to always be people who are going to be unhappy with the fact that their child is the 12th player on a 12-man team, or that their player, their son or daughter is a starter and somebody else is getting the bulk of the shots. So you're going to make people, I don't know if unhappy necessarily is the word, but you're not going to be able to please everybody. So what you have to do is set your standards, set your way of doing things, let everybody know what those ways are, and then, you know, stick to your guns and do the things that you believe are correct for the benefit of your kids, your program, your team. And if you do that, I think you're going to end up ultimately having long-term success.
Yeah. And find a way, you know, once again, take a little extra time to think about some of these things, but find a way, how can I utilize all my players? How can I keep them engaged? How can I, you know, can I schedule a couple get happy games during the year? Some games where I know I'm not going to need to play my starters a lot. You know, can I steal 1 minute or 2 minutes in the first half to let little Johnny play? You know, Jerry Tarkanian used to say when he was coaching at UNLV that if he thought there was any chance a player might have to play down the stretch, he wanted to play him a minute or two in the first half just to keep them engaged so that they weren't down at the water cooler looking at the cheerleaders the whole time.
So true.
And so there's got to be some ways. And I know we can't all choose our players, you know, especially the lower levels we go at youth sports. We can't always choose all of our players, but there's got to be something that every player can bring to the table. It's not going to be all around game, but there's got to be something that they can do or some way that they can stay engaged for the most part. And as a coach, that's what you got to do is try to figure that out. And certainly there's still those players or those parents that'll say, hey, yeah, you gave them a minute, but we wanted 2 minutes. You know, they'll always want a little bit more and they'll be unrealistic. But, you know, that way, if you can be honest with them up front, develop a little bit more relationship. And we've talked a lot about, you know, your coach-player relationship, and you got to have a strong bond, a strong connection if you want to have some tough conversations. The 100% is the truth for parents as well. If you're going to have a tough conversation with Johnny's dad, then you need to have a pretty strong bond with Johnny's dad, or he's not gonna listen to you.
Yeah, I agree 100%. That bond that you have between, you know, could even be coach, coach player, coach parent. You're going to be much better off having those tough conversations with people that you have a relationship with, that you've made some deposits in the bank already, that you can dip into when you're sitting across from the table with somebody and trying to come to an agreement on a difficult situation. Let's jump ahead, Jamie, from when you got to the end of your college coaching career and you kind of decided that you wanted to shift gears and get more into the leadership space. Talk about your decision-making process there and what made you want to transition and do something a little bit different than what you were doing previously.
Well, originally I got out of coaching because I had this weird idea that I wanted to be an athletic director. And so I left coaching. I left a great team to go be an athletic director for a large high school athletic program. And, you know, we had a lot of success. It was fun, you know, a lot of opportunity there. But once I was in that role, you know, I realized I'd always been a student of leadership. I'd always been somebody that loved leadership, thought that, you know, you could do a lot to impact the future by trying to train up the youth. You know, cause they're going to be our future leaders. And so I thought that, you know what, if I could do this full time, if I could go out and impact more people or start coaching coaches more than just the 20 coaches that were at my high school, you know, if I could do this on a full-time basis across the country, you know, maybe, you know, I could make more of a dent than what I'm doing, you know, as at just one school. And so I decided to leave and do this full time, kind of jump in with both feet. And it's been great. I've got to, you know, work with tons of coaches, tons of teams, you know, from all different levels, from NBA to middle school. You know, I mean, there was, you know, I'm working with an NBA team, working with the Raptors. And then that same week, I'm also working with a middle school. So it doesn't matter, because everybody has the same issues. It just might be at a different proportion or a different ratio, but everybody has the same issues, and they're just trying to be successful and you know, trying to fit in on a team and trying to do what they can individually to help their team or to find some significance with what they're doing. And so, as coaches, you're just trying to have a good program. Sometimes you're just trying not to bang your head against the wall. And so, I've enjoyed trying to help people in that respect.
So before we get into those issues and some of the things that you do and what you teach when you go in and work with the teams, I'd like you to talk a little bit about just how you got that business started, because, you know, obviously when you're going in and you're going to talk to NBA teams or you're going to talk to teams at the collegiate level, you have to, I'm assuming, build up your reputation, and you have to be able to sell yourself, and you have to be able to prove and show that you're going to add value. So how did you go about going from, okay, I'm a college coach, to now I'm in this leadership space? Talk about that transition and how you made what you're doing viable to give yourself an opportunity to do that on a full-time basis.
Yeah, it's really it's two pronged. One is you rely on your contacts, you rely on your network that you've already established, and then the second part is you just grind it. You cold call people. You get out there and you advertise or you market yourself. This is a problem that you have. What are your problems? What are the issues that you're dealing with? And this is how I might be able to help you. And from a business standpoint, you know, money changes hands when problems are solved. So people want their problems solved. They want things to be better. And so if you're a coach and you're struggling, you know, you're going to want somebody to help you out. So I was able to utilize my network of friends, network of contacts, and then just get out there and let people know that this is what I'm doing. And this is how I might be able to help you through my services or just coming in and speaking to your team one time or working with them on an ongoing basis. You know, whatever it is that you need for your team. And it looks very different for every team. You know, what I did for the Raptors is different than what I did for a middle school or what I might do for even a college program. Every situation is slightly different because every environment, every culture, every situation is slightly different. You know, and so, you know, I'll talk with that coach, or I work with whoever it is that identifies what that problem is, and we'll try to help them and try to develop a plan to help them be better and get the most out of their team members.
Would you say there's, obviously each situation is different, but would you say there's similarities to some of the issues that you see across, or what are some of the most common issues that you're asked to deal with when you come in and you work with a team?
Yeah, probably the number one thing is the teammate, how to be a good teammate. And I know that a lot falls under that. Like, that's not just a specific thing, but you know, when I was working with the Raptors, you know, you have double digit millionaires on that team, or all those guys were star players in college for the most part. You know, you got a guy with the Raptors, Fred Van Vliet. You know, he was an All-American at Wichita State. He was a very good player, but was undrafted, you know, and played in the G League his first year. So even though he didn't have a ton of success his first year and he went undrafted, he was still a star in college. And so you don't just automatically go from being a star and say, oh, I understand my place. You know, I'm a scrub in the NBA. No,
right.
I mean, you have ego. You're getting paid. You have ego. You know, you have pride, and that's what's made you so good, competitive pride for all these years. And so, you know, even at that level, you're dealing with, all right, how can I take, as a coach, how can I take 12 or 15 of these guys that all have agendas? They all have agents. They all have friends. They all have goals in life. They all have ego, pride, whatever you want to call it. How do I get them all to mesh and understand that the goal is more important than the role that they're playing? And so I think everybody has that. You know, if you're dealing with youth sports or middle school sports, you still have that. Those kids don't understand that just because they don't get the shot on this play, they could still be just as valuable as the person that takes a shot. And so you have to teach those players that. You have to teach how all of them can come together and utilize their skills. And as a coach, you know, I'm trying to help that coach understand how they can maximize the various strengths of their team, minimize the various weaknesses, and then motivate each person to maximize their strengths. And so you're working on both ends. You know, you're trying to help the players understand, and this is the main thing, you're trying to help them understand how they can be a better teammate and a more positive leader, no matter what their role is, because they're part of a team. With the coach, you're trying to help them to understand how they can bring the best out of each one of those people. And that's difficult to do sometimes, because we do want to, you know, when Steph Curry hits that shot, you know, to win the game, we want to high five Steph Curry and talk about Steph's shot also. But we forget that Kevin Looney might have set the screen, or Andre Iguodala might have been the one that passed him the ball and then cut down the lane so hard that the help had to go on to Andre Iguodala, and that made the shot more open. You know, those are the kinds of things we have to catch our players, catch them being good, catch them doing what they're supposed to do as coaches. And then that helps them then be more encouraged and motivated next time to do those kind of things. So that's the kind of stuff that you're trying to do is it. And that's the main issue that teams deal with. Now, it's different in golf or different in tennis, where it's more individual. But when you're dealing with the team sports, it's almost always putting your ego aside for the good of the team, because we don't want to do that. We want our names in the paper. We want adulation. We want all this stuff, and we don't always get it in a team concept. And so you have to understand, or you have to help those players understand, you know, what's in it for them. Why should they give in, and why should they sacrifice for the good of the team? And then the coaches, you help them understand that they have to promote and recognize and praise those people that are doing those team concepts.
So when you go in and you're working with, just let's use the Raptors as an example, when you're working with them and you're talking to the players and you're trying to help the players to understand how important it is to be a great teammate and to buy into the team concept, is that something that you're doing with the entire team at one time? Is that through a series of individual conversations, sessions with players by themselves, some combination of that. Explain sort of the process of how you go about instilling some of the things that you're trying to teach.
Yeah. Each situation, like I mentioned before, is kind of different. In the Raptors situation, it was mini camp in LA, a couple different occasions where I was meeting with the whole team. So I would speak to the whole team, and then I would be on site for 24 to 48 hours, watching them work out, hanging with them at the hotel, hanging with them at the workout facility at meals. And so what I would be able to do is I would be able to talk to them individually if that situation arose, where I was able to talk to them. I was able to talk with the coaches, be in the coaches' meetings, give them my observations. But as far as the players themselves, you know, you would talk to them and there's been situations where I have not with the Raptors, but other situations where you have intentional time where yes, you can meet with the players. It's intentional. It's built in. With the Raptors, it was not built in that situation. So it was one of those where, you know, it's a one-off type thing while so-and-so is getting his shoes on or getting taped, or, you know, you have 5 minutes here with this player, 5 minutes over here with this player. I noticed with one player, he didn't touch the line a couple times when they were doing sprints. And so he came over for the water break, or it was at the end, and they're taking off their shoes, you know, pretty much putting on their slides or their casual shoes. And I pull up one of my tweets actually from the day before, and it shows a player missing the line or not touching the line. And it says something about the difference between winning or losing during your season, something like that. And I showed that to him, and he was like, "Oh yeah, I guess I probably should have touched the line, shouldn't I?" You know, and so little things like that. And then we start talking about, you know, what are the little things that you're doing to set yourself apart? You know, because it's one thing if you're DeMar DeRozan, you know, and you're an NBA all-star, you know, and still there's things you got to do as the star to set yourself apart and keep making yourself better. But if you're the 10th man or the 11th man or the 12th man, you need to find a way to show not only your organization now, but future organizations possibly that you're somebody that could be in the league for 12 to 15 years, because that's life-changing money. If you're just there for 2 years, you may not make enough money for your next generations to live, you know. But so those are the kinds of things, you know, you need to pay attention to those kind of things. You need to, what are you doing to differentiate yourself? And when I went out to summer league in Vegas, you know, it's the same thing. You see a lot of star players in college that don't make it in the pros because they don't understand what to do during a timeout when they're not playing. They don't understand what to do when they're hurt. They don't understand how they're supposed to act when they're not the person getting the shots. But those are the very people that stay around for 10, 12, 15 years in the NBA. And then we say, hey, that player's no good. But the player's actually pretty good. They've just found their role in the NBA that helps teams win, and they're making a lot of money for 15 years.
If you're a basketball coach in the greater Cleveland area and you have a passion for teaching the game and might be interested in joining the Head Start Basketball Camp coaching staff this summer, please reach out to us via email at headstartbasketball@usa.net.
How long does it take for a player to be receptive to some of the things that you're saying? Because a lot of times, you know, I mean, obviously the player that you talked to from the Raptors knows he's supposed to be touching the line. And so when you come over and you say, hey, you really, you know, you show them the tweet and you really should be touching the line. How many guys are receptive to that and immediately are like, oh yeah, you're right, versus how many guys are just rolling their eyes and being like, yeah, I get it. And then obviously, like you said, those are the guys that end up being out of the league because they can't figure out how to be the ninth man or the 12th man and do the things that the coaches are asking and be a great teammate and be coachable. How receptive do you find guys to be at that level?
No, that's a great point. And I will say that there were probably three or four other guys that weren't touching lines as well. And I never said anything to them because I hadn't established any kind of a relationship with them. I hadn't talked to them previously to the point where they would trust or that they would, you know, all I was this guy that talked to them.
Right.
You know, I wasn't a guy that they had built up any trust with yet. Like, I had credibility as a so-called expert, but I didn't have the credibility that I cared about that person or that I had taken any time to talk to them or we had built any kind of credits up in that emotional bank account. The player that I talked to, we had already had a conversation a couple times. And he, not that we were best friends or not that he knew exactly that I cared about him, but we had a good enough relationship where I could say something to him. So, and I do think that that goes a little bit deeper in terms of, you know, sometimes we will, you know, confront a player that we don't have a very good relationship with, and it'll kind of get that confrontation will be escalated a little bit because we don't have a relationship with them. And sometimes, you know, that's where we got to build up that those credits and that emotional bank account if we're going to have some conversations with people. And I know, you know, this is kind of silly, but there's been a couple times where I did not have a relationship with a player, but I had a very strong relationship with their roommate. And so I might use that roommate as a go-between or an ambassador just right. to smooth something over or to send my message, to get my message across to that player.
Yeah, I think that it goes back to, I mean, we've sort of been the theme that's running through the entire podcast tonight is you have to build relationships as a coach in order to be able to get across whatever point it is that you want to make. It could be a point of X's and O's. It could be a point of leadership. It could be a point about a life lesson. The more receptive the player is going to be if you have built that relationship prior to getting into some of those things with the players. Let's talk a little bit about your book, The Leadership Playbook. Can you just describe for people what the book is all about and why someone would benefit from going out and picking up a copy?
Yeah, it's separated into chapters based on topics. And so there might be a verbal leadership chapter where I provide stories and insights about how a player can be a better verbal leader. And it's not necessarily the Tim Tebow, Michael Jordan-esque. Those kind of verbal leaders are few and far between. It's the verbal leader of just, hey, as long as you can speak, then you can be a verbal leader because you can encourage, you can talk to your teammate on the bus, at the restaurant, in the cafeteria, in the dorm room. So you can be a verbal leader. And so the book is split up into chapters like that, where I give a ton of stories, a lot of stories from the news, from the world of sports, the sports news, from my own personal experiences. And we, you know, we go with that to help them learn more. And each story, there's it's kind of a bolded section or a bolded title to each story. So let's say you're a football player and you're just thumbing through the book. You might come across one section that says Julio Jones or a section of Tom Brady. And so you might want to read that little, you know, 4 or 5 paragraph story. And each story has a lesson to it within those chapters. So we break it down. It's not for captains. It's not for non-captains. It's for everybody because we believe that everybody can be a leader, not just the senior, not just the starter, not just the captain. Everybody can be a leader because everybody has influence. And so we've had a lot of success with the book. You know, there's been a lot of teams that have bought the book and had their teams go through it. We also have a discussion guide that coaches can get with that, a 1-page discussion guide if they want to take their team through it. So I'm biased because I wrote it, but that's those are the very stories or the very things that I will use even with the Raptors, with a high school team, with a college team. Those are some of the very stories and lessons that I will use with teams. And so we just put it in a book.
All right. So you mentioned being a vocal leader doesn't necessarily mean being the rah-rah out in front of everybody type of leader. It's doing things quietly behind the scenes, just having that conversation at lunch with a teammate or finding out what makes them go or what's going on with their family or, you know, while you're stretching at practice. Those are all little things that a player can do to be a better leader, be a better teammate. What are one or two other things that if a player's listening or if a coach is listening, something that they might be able to suggest to their players that someone could do to be a better leader?
Yeah. Well, one of the things is just, you know, like you mentioned, the verbal leadership, the encouraging or get your friend. Once again, going back to the relationship thing. And I think this is important because I see this all the time, both when I was coaching and now while I consult and work with teams, is that one player will try to motivate another player or will yell or say something to a player, but they don't have a relationship with that player that's real strong. And so that player will roll their eyes or they won't be motivated, but they just called them out in public. You really can't do that. And I see so many players do that because they're trying to be leaders. But the better leadership skill would be to pull that kid off on the side later on, or to say something to this, to that kid, or to find some way to encourage that kid, as opposed to just yelling at them. And a lot of times we don't have a relationship with a teammate as strong as we would like, and yet we try to essentially to force that kid to live up to our standards when we're just another teammate. And that can cause resentment. I think as coaches, we need to do a better job of teaching our players how to be better leaders. First of all, how to lead ourselves. You know, are we doing what we're supposed to do first? And then secondly, are we getting our two or three closest friends to do those very things? You know, for most kids, especially at youth sports or high school, you don't even almost ever have to get into, all right, how can I lead my whole team? You're not going to lead your whole team because most of us aren't, you know, Tim Tebow. I'm dating myself a little bit, but or a Michael Jordan or a Tom Brady, who when we snap our fingers, everybody's going to do what we say because we're just so awesome. Most of us are only really going to influence and lead two or three of our closest friends. And so we want to try to get our players to be able to do that and understand that, hey, you know, if I'm in college, my roommate, you know, I need to do what I'm supposed to do first, but then can I get my roommate to do what they're supposed to do also? Or in high school, who's my best friend or my best two friends that I always hang with? You know, if they're not doing what I'm doing, you know, in a positive way, then why is that the case? And so as coaches, you know, hey, can I get each of my players to do what they're supposed to do first? And then can I get them to influence and bring along two or three of their closest friends? And instead of so essentially it's that old elephant, you know, story. How do you eat an elephant? Well, one bite at a time. How do you lead a team? One teammate at a time. And a lot of times I think we try to bite off too much and we say, all right, we got to lead the team. No, you don't necessarily have to lead a team. You have to lead yourself and you have to lead your closest friends. And then eventually, you know, you're going to have a domino effect. Eventually people are going to start influencing each other and you're going to have a whole bunch of pockets of people doing what they're supposed to do. And then you're going to have a team moving forward.
Yeah, I love that, because to put the leadership role on one kid, and now I'm thinking from the perspective of a high school coach, if I expect my one 16-year-old, 17-year-old kid to be a leader of my entire team, that's a lot to put on most kids. And most kids at that age aren't ready for that type of responsibility. But if you say, hey, I want you to lead your best buddy on the team, or I want you to lead the two other people that you hang out with the most, who you have the most influence with, who you have the best relationship with, that to me seems eminently more doable than saying, go lead all 12 of these guys who, yeah, they're your teammates, but they may not be your best friends. We all know how, you know, high school and college works, and you're not always best friends with everybody on your team. There are people you like more than others. There are people you're really good friends with. And oftentimes there might even be people on that team that you don't really like at all. And to ask somebody who's 17 years old to lead somebody who they don't like, that's a lot to put on them. So I think if you can find a way, as you just described, to have them lead those small groups, eventually, if you get all those small groups rowing in the same direction, then as a coach, you really got something. I love that, Jamie.
Yeah. And a lot of this comes down to, we're all, you know, no matter what sport we're coaching, if it's a team sport, we're trying to get, you know, however many individuals we have to buy into one common goal, or to put their stuff up on the shelf, to put their agendas to the side for the good of the team. And so, but a lot of times as coaches, we don't promote that, though. We don't praise, we don't celebrate when people do that. We don't celebrate that 10th grader or that 9th grader on our team who just handed somebody a cup of water at a timeout, or who moved down on the bench so someone could sit there, or who was the first one up to slap a hand. We don't do those kind of things. And then we don't teach people, hey, that's what being a teammate's all about. It's not about scoring buckets, even though that's great. It's about all this other stuff. And you know what, if you're going to do that, I'm going to praise you. And I'm going to point that out just as much as I'm going to point out the person that shot the ball. And, you know, as coaches, we talk all the time about the little things. you know, and it's normally from a negative standpoint. The little things lead to problems. The little things lead to problems. You know, if we don't take care of these little things, we'll have big problems. But the reverse is true. If we pay attention to the little things, the good things, then that can lead to more people doing what they're supposed to do. Because the reality is, you know, we want praise. We want to feel like we're doing what we're supposed to do, but we want to feel like we're being acknowledged for that. And so everyone wants a slap on the back. Everybody wants a kind word. And so the more you encourage someone, they're going to be a little bit more inspired to do that again. And you know, in the short term, yeah, we can take the whip to somebody, so to speak. You know, are we going to lead by the carrot or the stick? And in the short term, the stick might get somebody. We might be able to prod someone into doing something, but that's not going to build any long-term buy-in, any ownership. They're not going to internalize what we're saying, and therefore our culture is not going to be great. But if we can get people to buy into what we're selling, and make no mistake, we are salespeople. You know, we're not selling used cars, but we are selling a vision. We're selling our program. We're selling ourselves. And they're going to buy things from people that they know, like, and trust. And they're not going to know, like, and trust us very much if we're always negative, or if we're not catching them being good, if we're not celebrating the good things that they're doing.
Yeah, you got to really make it a point to notice those things and point them out, and point them out publicly, you know, and that also goes to knowing your kids. You know, most people are, you know, love getting praise in public. I know I've coached players though that get embarrassed and don't like getting that public praise necessarily, but maybe just they like somebody to whisper in their ear that, you know, hey, you did a great job, or hey, I noticed you did that. And that encourages them to continue that behavior. But I find that for myself, especially, and I'm sure other coaches experience this too, is it goes back to something you said earlier about spending 5 minutes in the car thinking about your practice or your drills or the things that you're going to do. And I know that I do a much better job of looking for those teachable moments, those things that great teammates do, when I'm intentional about it and when I've thought about it prior to stepping out on the practice floor or prior to a game. It's easy to get caught up in some of the other things, again, the more technical side of coaching. And you really have to, at least for me, I find I have to be very, very intentional about the idea of, hey, I want to make sure that I'm looking for the behavior on the bench during this game. I want to make sure that I'm observing who's giving out a high five, who's running off the floor when they sub out quickly and not sulking when they have to come out of the game, and who's doing the things that we've established are going to be part of our program. And I think it's really, really important for coaches to be intentional about the things that you just described.
Yeah. You know, if you hit a game-winning shot, you know, or something like that happens, or you guys win a tough game down the stretch, you know, obviously you don't ignore the person who hit the shot, but you want to praise those other things. But you can also praise someone that wasn't even on the floor at that point by saying something like, you know, we almost all have practice squads, you know, hey guys, I'm not shocked whatsoever that we were able to come back, or that we were able to finish that game off, even though it was emotional and tough, because all week, you know, you and you, our practice squad gave us all that we could handle, and they prepared us, and we won that game because those guys prepared us on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday for this Friday game. Or, you know, I knew we were going to do that because back in the second quarter, I remember when Jalen did this, and he did that, and that set us up for this final play. And that might be something that people completely forgot about, but you point those kind of things out. And I think that goes a long way, not only for Jalen, you know, feeling good about himself, but it goes a long way for your team, because now they're like, you know what, coach noticed that. I didn't notice that, but coach noticed that. You know, coach, when he tells us to be a team, he really means it.
Yeah, everybody gets recognized. It's easy to recognize players 1, 2, and 3 on your team who are making huge contributions out on the court during games. It's a lot harder just to naturally praise player 13, 14, and 15. I think it goes back to what I said earlier. You have to be intentional about looking for those opportunities to praise those kids. And like you said, it doesn't necessarily have to be what they did in that moment in the game, because there might not be something that you can point to right in that moment, but you can go back and praise them for things that they've done in the past, for preparing the team, or for just being being a vocal leader, being somebody who in this drill worked hard, or being in the drill, the person who dove on the floor, being the guy who was talking to their teammates during the stretching and trying to get everybody's enthusiasm level up. Those are all things that coaches can find and coaches can praise players for, but that we don't always do because we're just not intentional about going ahead and doing that. Jamie, we're coming up on an hour and a half. I want to give you a chance to talk a little bit about your Success is a Choice podcast and tell us a little bit of how you got it started, what your motivations were for getting it going, and then kind of where it is right now and how much you've enjoyed doing it.
Yeah, I appreciate that. We, I like to listen to podcasts, and I was like, man, if I could get some of these guests on my podcast, or if I could get the chance to ask them questions that I want to have answered, that would be really cool. And so, I started that, about a year and a half ago or about, and, we're over 100 episodes. We're like at 120 episodes now, and it's been great. Now the podcast, the Success is a Choice podcast, it's, I interview people from all different walks of life. So this is not, you know, business or marketing people would say this is the wrong, business strategy for the podcast because I don't have a target audience. It's not just coaches, not just athletics. I mean, I just interviewed a former singer with the Pussycat Dolls. I've interviewed pastors. I've interviewed, business people. I've interviewed coaches, certainly. You know, so I've interviewed people all across the board, and it's been fun because everybody has a story to some degree and everybody has lessons that they've learned, and whether we agree with someone or not, or like somebody's philosophies, or whether or not someone screwed up or not, we can learn from screw-ups. We can learn from successful people. Now, everybody I've interviewed, I think, is successful and has an interesting story to tell, but we can learn from everybody. So if I'm a coach, I could learn from an entertainer. I can learn from, you know, somebody else. And so I've enjoyed having different people on the show.
So two questions. One, who's been the most interesting guest that you've had from a surprise standpoint? Somebody that maybe is not well known that brought more to the table than maybe what you anticipated. That's the first question. And then the second question is, who's the dream guest for the show that if you could just kind of wave your magic wand and get anybody on to your show, who would that person be?
Probably, you know, I have a lot of guests that I wouldn't mind being on the show, but you know, and this will totally, I don't think people would guess this in a million years probably, but Tyler Perry is my dream guest. He does the Medea shows. I would love to have him on. I wish I could say that it's something that's really, really deep, but, I think he's really talented and I'd just love to talk to him because I think he's got a level head, but, you know, that's just a personal thing. I wish I was deeper and could give you, oh, I wish I had this coach on, or I wish I had this politician on, you know, outside of the main ones. You know, I think everybody would love to have like a Tiger Woods or a Barack Obama or a Donald Trump or, you know, Oprah Winfrey, something like that. I think everybody would like to do that, but somebody maybe that you wouldn't think of, Tyler Perry. And then the guests that I had on, I had two guests on that you know, come to mind right away. One is Betsy Butterick, and most people would not know Betsy, but she's a communication specialist, a former athlete, a former college basketball coach, and she does communication work with a lot of different sports teams and businesses. And, you know, every time I talk to her or listen to her, I feel guilty about the way I communicate, especially with my wife. I'm like, man, I got to do a better job. But she actually spoke before me at the Women's Final Four last week down in Tampa. And the place was packed to listen to her. And I feel like the people that stayed and listened to me, it was a downer for them. But no, she's awesome. And that was a fun episode. I knew she'd be good, but that's one that I would definitely recommend to anybody. And then I also had Dwayne Casey of the Raptors on. And Dwayne Casey, you know, we all know that coaches in the NBA, you know, you got to be smart. You got to have your X's and O's in order, or else you're not going to be in the NBA very long. But I've been so impressed with his character, and he knows how to get the best out of his players. And he's one of those guys that absolutely He's not necessarily a player's coach, but he is a player's coach, if that makes sense. Like, he's not the player's coach, stereotypical one that people walk all over and lets his players do anything, but all of his players love him. And, you know, and he also has a great story. You know, most people don't realize, but he got in trouble with the NCAA, and the NCAA slapped a show cause on him, and he couldn't coach forever. And he had to go to
Japan. The Chris Mills envelope.
Chris Mills, yeah. For those people that don't know, you know, that was a recruiting violation that he allegedly sent money to essentially the top recruit in the country, sent money to him, and the envelope came open, and the money was there. And Kentucky went on, got in trouble, and he couldn't coach in college anymore. He had to go to Japan to coach, and eventually he worked his way into the NBA. But he actually it came out that he was not at fault and he didn't do anything wrong, and the NCAA had to pay him a ton of money. But he was I love his story because, you know, certainly that hurt him, but he used that as motivation, as fuel. And he has a strong character, and it's a good lesson also in forgiveness and not being a victim to the circumstances.
Yeah, it's a total testament to perseverance and just the amount of passion that obviously he had for the game of basketball to be able to overcome that. Because I can remember, I think I was probably in middle school at the time that that happened. Maybe I was in high school by that point. And wow, I mean, just, you know, that was a huge story back in the day. And, you know, for him to be able to eventually be exonerated and having gone through all the things and stress that I'm sure accompanied that, and to come out on the other end and, you know, be the NBA coach of the year. And, you know, now he's got the Pistons in the playoffs. We'll see what they can do. You know, we'll see what they can do with Milwaukee. I'm guessing they're not going to be able to do too much, but we'll have to see what happens here. But that's, you know, again, just a great story that he was able to overcome that, what was a very difficult circumstance back when he was a young coach. Before we get out of here, Jamie, I want to give you a chance to share your contact information with people, and also let them know where they can find the book, where they can listen to the podcast. And then if there's anything that we didn't touch on that you want to share with the audience, go ahead and do that now, and then we'll wrap things up.
Well, I appreciate that, Mike. And yeah, pretty much they can find the podcast, they can find the book stuff all at coachbeckler.com, and that's B-E-C-H-L-E-R. But coachbeckler.com, they can find all that stuff. We've also done a basketball ebook. It's called Talking About Practice, kind of playing off of Allen Iverson.
Nice.
Talking About Practice. But it's a whole bunch of ideas how to take your practices to another level. And that's a free ebook that they can get also at our website. So they can listen to podcasts, they can get our books, all that kind of stuff. Follow me on Twitter at Coach Beckler. We try to put out good stuff. We try not to be controversial. We try to spell things right. We try to do all the things that we try to keep it positive, try to promote positive leadership, and give you some insights that maybe you can take back with your team or to influence the people around you.
Jamie, this has been fantastic. We can't thank you enough for spending an hour and a half with us tonight. It's been an absolute pleasure. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks. Head Start Basketball's Player Development Academy offers Cleveland area players a unique opportunity to improve their basketball skills. Regardless of a player's age, skill level, or position, training with Head Start Basketball will elevate your game to the next level. Do you want to improve your ball handling, become a better shooter, or develop into a more skilled, confident player? Our academy classes offer training that's designed to do just that. Our training sessions are innovative and will have you learning skills that are transferable to actual games. We have 4 different class skill levels for boys and girls, ages 4 and up. All Player Development Academy classes will be held at the Strongsville Recreation Center. For more information or to get registered, please visit www.headstartbasketball.com.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.